Hello, and welcome to Ask Dr. Dawn. The opinions expressed in this program are those of the speakers, and this is a program intended for education and entertainment. It should not be construed as a substitute for a medical consultation. I wanted to start out with a little personal news and a little personal invitation and a little backstory. So, first of all, I want to invite you to come over to the west side of Santa Cruz and visit the Restore. That's at 719 Swift Street, where for the month of October, I will have an art show up of some of my assemblage work. I got started doing clay a long time ago as a way of dealing with some of the stress and the tragedy and the pain that is just part of having a career in medicine. And, you know, you can find your solution at the bottom of a bottle, or you can find your solution at the bottom of a bag of clay. And, the clay is healthier. So this program is called, the show, rather, is called Emotional Baggage. And it is a series of assemblage pieces I've made using fragments of old toys and old suitcases and other odds and ends. And I'm basically telling stories. You can think of it as a slideshow of adverse childhood experiences. Some of them are depicted, some of them are just suggested, and they run the gamut. So let's talk about the ACE study. This was done in the mid-1990s by the Kaiser Foundation and by Kaiser Permanente physicians, and they wanted to study the effects of adverse childhood experiences on health, and they thought there were probably some correlations, and they wanted to try and come up with a numeric score and do some handicapping in terms of, if you have one adverse child experience, how bad is that for your health and your long-term probability of a happy longevity? And what about if you have four or five? And as it turns out, the effect is not additive, but multiplicative. And the statistics are pretty startling. There's been a lot of research done later. This study was so startling, in fact, that they did a follow-up study in the early 80s, asked a few more questions. And what they found was the biggest and best eraser for an adverse childhood experience is having one adult. You only need one, but they need to be on your side. You need to know they love you, you need to know they'll protect you, and you need to know they've got your back no matter what. And if you've got that, then it erases a lot, if not all, of the adverse effects of a couple of adverse childhood experiences. I recommend or encourage you to go Google that and take the quiz. See how many ACEs you've got in your particular deck. You can search for Adverse Childhood Experiences Questionnaire to get the test, and that'll pop right up to the top of your search. So do a little bit of an editorial. I always read both the regular conventional medical literature and the unconventional medical literature, let's call it. And I came across this ad that I just had to, like, first of all, when you're reading a drug ad, you want to read the fine print. But I think this drug is so bad and so terrible to give to patients that I just want to warn people about it. This is being promoted very heavily now to primary care doctors. In their first wave, they went after the gastroenterologists. Now, in an ad in Family Medicine, which everybody gets for free, there's a big ad on page 5 saying, think Xifaxan first. When patients present with symptoms of irritable bowel syndrome with diarrhea, think Xifaxan first. Then there's a couple of short phrases here. Short-term therapy, lasting relief. So let's see what it says when you read the footnotes there. Short-term therapy. People who experience recurrence can be treated up to twice. Oh, that's good. I guess that means a lot of patients experience recurrence. Lasting relief. Median of average of 10 weeks with a range of 6 to 24 weeks. So you can treat someone's diarrhea. You can knock out every bit of bacteria they've got in their gut practically. And by the way, put them at risk for C. difficile while you're at it. And yeah, their diarrhea will go away because they don't have any bugs anymore. lasting relief? Well, I don't call 10 weeks on the average lasting relief, especially when you can just retreat with this highly expensive drug, I might add, on which they have a huge profit margin. Well, each time you treat, you drive down that microbiome diversity, which in most of us is already too low for us to be healthy. So it's equivalent to saying, weeds in your garden? Well, we have Agent Orange. Spray your cropland with Agent Orange and you won't have any weeds anymore. This stuff is like the Agent Orange of antibiotics as far as the gut is concerned, and it is worse than Roundup. It's a terrible thing to do, and it frustrates me to no end that in the wake of all of the research, I mean, we're not talking obscure journals here. We're talking like Scientific American did something in 2016 about the microbiome and its importance. No, this isn't even like obscure medical literature. Doctors should know about this. And the fact that they don't is, and that this ad is going to work is really surprising to me. So by the way, the generic name of this stuff is Rifaximin, and they changed it to something a little catchier, Xifaxan. This is the alien overlord of drugs. Do not let your doctor give you this stuff. There are much better treatments for irritable bowel with diarrhea, including for over 50% of people who actually have this and actually do it, a simple elimination diet, which you can find online just by Googling that. And having decided that this was going to be my lead story, I also decided that I would give you a book review, a book I just finished reading, that I thought was a very good book for the lay person to help you understand the microbiome. And furthermore, the emerging research that shows that our microbiome and our brain, particularly the anxiety and depression pathways in our brain, develop, well, simultaneously and kind of co-evolve and talk to each other through a large cable system called the vagus nerve, not to mention the bloodstream, but the vagus nerve is a direct line into the brain, crosses the blood-brain barrier, and there are a lot of metabolites from the bacteria in your gut that you might recognize. Some of you may have taken a drug called Calm, which contains GABA. Well, your gut makes GABA, certain bacteria make it. It's a calming substance, and it also induces a mild reward symbol. So the bacteria are saying, yeah, that was a great thing to have eaten, Jack. Eat some more. Here, have a little Valium. And effectively, it's the bacteria's attempt to, and I'm humanizing this, or anthropomorphizing it rather, to reward you. Really, it's just survival. If I send this signal, good things happen in the future. So they send that signal. I don't think they're actually being thinking in the way that we think, but they might as well be. In the mind-gut connection, Emran Meyer, that's Emranmeyer, explores this coevolution and the kind of ping-pong of communication, and also how when this goes wrong, we have serious problems with inflammation. Let's go to our next story, inflammation, right? We're talking about inflammation of the lungs. This is a follow-up on the vaping. We're now calling it vaping-associated pulmonary injury. And in California, well, let's see, since June 2019, this is dated October 1st, there were 102 cases of hospitalization. In California, there have been 102 cases that required hospitalization, I should say. There have been two deaths in California. The median age of this is 27. All the young people are the ones who are vaping now. And what we're seeing with this is that it's not just the THC. Some of the people are, maybe they're stonewalling, but they say they've only been using nicotine products. And there are lots of things in that vape fluid, propylene glycol, glycerin, ultrafine particles, nickel, tin, lead, volatile organic compounds like airplane glue type stuff, and flavoring chemicals that have never, never been approved for the use as an inhalant. And of course, we heard last week that some of it has vitamin E oil in it, and that's never, you don't want to inhale oils. So if you vape, here are the symptoms to beware about. Coughing, pain when you breathe in, and that's an important one because people don't usually get that unless they've got a serious pulmonary problem. Shortness of breath, fever, although that's late, lots of fatigue, maybe some nausea and diarrhea, maybe some weight loss. But if you go to the doctor and you're a vapor and you have any of these symptoms, have them check your oxygen. All doctor's offices have the finger oximeters, and they can check your oxygen. And one of the early findings that we're seeing is a drop in oxygen lower than what you would expect for someone that age. And this is before the fever hits, and it's before you get so sick that you might need mechanical ventilation. Now, diagnosis of this is tricky because you have to rule out all the other diseases. Treatment, well, basically give people extra oxygen. We think maybe early on steroids may be helpful. So this might be one where I would give someone oxygen. I would give someone prednisone. I would give someone all of those things. Another finding that can be helpful if you're trying as a doctor or a healthcare provider to sort this out is that the liver enzymes bump. And that's not something that you typically see in pneumonia, but since the body's dealing with a toxin, that certainly makes sense. So I just want to put it out there and encourage you to have a high alert for this vaping-associated pulmonary injury. This is some serious stuff here, and you do not want to stonewall and not go in to see the doctor. If you're having these symptoms, particularly if you're a regular daily user, this is something you need to pay attention to. Now, would I ask you to stop using? Yeah, I would say right now we should find other things to smoke. There is a great abundance of things to smoke in our Santa Cruz community. So I don't think you'll be in great trouble or suffering too terribly. So let's talk about a latest study that showed, you probably saw it in the newspaper, that high-dose vitamin D may actually do more, quote-unquote, do more harm than good. And this is this study has a few flaws, but I'll tell you about it. They took vitamin D, 3, which is the one you should be taking, at doses of either 4,000 or 10,000 daily. And those of you who are regular listeners have heard me say that I usually like to use 5,000 a day. I don't like people to take 10,000 except under a doctor's observation and for a specific reason, because I thought that too much of a hormone might have the anti-hormone effect. And I've been saying that for years, and this study is the first one that says, well, maybe that's true. It's a reasonably good study. I'm trying to find. It was not a big study, though, and so there's a lot of chance that this could be just random. It needs to be replicated before we make any changes. But basically, we had around 100 people. 50 got 10,000, 50 got 4,000, and then they had another couple of hundred people who took the standard dose, which was 400 units, which is typically what you'll find in a vitamin pill. And they looked at bone mineral density in the tibia, and they showed a loss of bone mineral density, not very significant, but statistically significant in the group that took the 10,000. They also measured levels, and so this was instructive because the people who took 10,000 a day for 3 years had levels of basically what we would I'm going to translate it because they gave it in micromoles. So they had at the 1 year mark, no, 3 month mark, they had levels of 75 nanograms per milliliter. And at 3 years, they had levels of 144, which works out to about 57. Now, the people who took 4,000 units had pretty much the same levels. They didn't have a 75 at 3 months. They had a 46 at 3 months, so they were coming up more slowly. And they probably didn't trigger the body turning off vitamin D because you were getting kind of toxic on it. And I think that's what happened in the 10,000 unit group, because they dropped from 75 to 57 and they ended up in almost exactly the same territory as the 400 group. And this is one of the things that makes me wonder about this study, is because of the people in of when they measured the bone mineral density, there was a decline in the 10,000 group that was greater than the decline in the 4,000 group or in the decline in the 400 group. They were looking at tibia, and it was very, very small study. So I think that there may be some support for the idea that too much high-dose vitamin D3 may actually backfire and create a counter-regulatory reaction. The amounts of bone lost were not clinically important. They were statistically significant, and it's always important to talk about that difference, the difference between clinically significant and statistically significant can be the Grand Canyon. And I would refer, for example, to the fact that you have to treat 50 high-risk men for a decade with statins to prevent one heart attack. But that's very statistically significant. Clinically, I think you could make the argument that it's not really significant, or at least 49 people would be raising their hands. Then again, one person would be raising his hand saying, well, it worked for me, guys. You know, I'll be your poster child. First email is from Alan, who declines to state where he's coming from, and Alan wants to ask about apples. On previous shows, you've recommended stewed or cooked apples as a source of prebiotic pectin and organic apples as sources of probiotics. If I cook the apples, the probiotics die in the heat, right? So eat cooked and fresh organic apples, yes? Thanks. Well, the apples don't really, in terms of the fiber does not care if it is cooked. A lot of people find it hard to eat as much fresh apples as cooked apples, and many people can't manage the fresh apples well because of tooth problems. The stewed apples, and I'll give you a recipe for stewed apples in a minute, but the fact is the probiotics are dead, but the apples still contain spores. And one of the other lessons that we talked about on that program was how eating different apples gave you different bacteria spores. Bacteria spores are really hard to kill. So when you do canning, for example, you boil things in a pressure cooker because you can't kill the bacterial spores readily. And that's why, for example, improperly canned foods can contain botulism, because the spores are still in there. And as soon as you open the can, they get oxygen and they start to reproduce. The spores can germinate in your gut because it is, to a large extent, an anaerobic environment. Plus, the dead bodies of probiotics still contain chemical signals called lipopolysaccharides that can either be pro-inflammatory or anti-inflammatory depending upon the bacteria. So the dead bodies of probiotics are an effective signaling. And the apples, as you said, are great bacteria chow. So I promised you a recipe for stewed apples. I just boil apples. I'm very lazy, but I have a Vitamix. So the lazy doctor's stewed apples is basically quarter the apples, cut out the core, leave the skin on, boil it for 15 to 20 minutes until they start to float and they're kind of foamy, like spongy. Let that cool down, drain off most of the water, throw it in the Vitamix, and burn, baby, burn, churn, baby, churn, and you get a lovely, smooth, kind of lemon curd stewed apple that is really different from applesauce, and I just find it It's a fabulous, healthy dessert. Just don't eat too much of it because it is still has some fructose in it. So don't go crazy. The number to call, 900-5773, or you can email at onair@ksquid.org. And don't forget, you can also go to AskDrDawn.com and look at our archive of programs, listen to this week's program, posts, you know, somewhere around 7 days after we finish here. And I highly encourage you to do that. You can also send me a message, feedback, or a question at the Contact Us. Lately, we've been posting every Sunday after the show, getting it up there very promptly. We're back into a routine now that we're here at KSQED on a weekly basis. Another email, and this is from Sam Price in St. Louis. And Sam writes, osteoporosis and bone health. You recently discussed calcium supplements for osteoporosis. I get my medical info from you and Dr. Geiger at nutritionfacts.org. So I don't know what to do when I hear seemingly conflicting info. I'll put in a link below. But could you talk about the studies indicating the associated coronary risk might outweigh the benefits of calcium supplements? Of course, I'm a long-term listener, and thanks for your years of providing such useful information. Thanks again, Sam. And he gives me a link. So I went to the link, nutritionfacts.org, and you can find it. It's a blog, so the date was 2018/03/27. And it's kind of a short blog by Dr. Geiger, and I have some criticisms of it. He calls his blog evidence-based nutrition, but he kind of leaves out the evidence. There are no references or links to references, and he doesn't really specifically in this blog talk about the cardiac disease except in a couple of sentences, and I couldn't figure out what studies he was talking about. If you go back in the archives, Sam, you will find a discussion where I talk about one of the specific studies, which was an epidemiologic study linking calcium supplements to an increased risk of heart attack and events, coronary artery, so heart attacks and acute myocardial syndrome, which is like a heart attack that doesn't actually go forward because we've got such good response rates now. I want to start by saying that none of this data shows that calcium causes heart attacks. Assigning causality requires a very different kind of evidence than just epidemiology. I could, for example, talk about a study that just came out that showed that people who wear fitness trackers and have the least activity on their fitness trackers have the most mortality. That's true. But then again, people who are sick don't move around a whole lot, and they might be getting ready to get sick and die or in the process of fighting cancer. So you'd expect them to have lower activity. And if you don't know the backstory, it's not the fitness tracker and it's not the activity. It's the disease causing the inactivity. So causality has an arrow. This causes this. Correlation is just an association. These things happen more often together. It doesn't tell you what's going on. And it's super important for that. So let's talk about these epidemiologic studies in a little more detail. We know that calcium accumulates in diseased arteries. We know that if you do accumulate calcium in your arteries, it makes them more rigid. So not everybody with diseased arteries gets calcium in them. Some people get a lot of calcium and they've got stiff arteries, but they don't actually have a lot of plaque. There's a lot of genetics at work here. And when you have epidemiology and you're not checking the genetics, you may find that people with a tendency to accumulate calcium, who take calcium, accumulate more calcium in their arteries, and if their arteries are already diseased with plaque, that will trigger a heart attack. But it isn't exactly like the calcium is causing it. It's more like it's contributing it to it in susceptible individuals. So if you have a susceptible diseased artery and you have the genetics to accumulate calcium in your arteries, then you might have an earlier MI. And since we have a treatment for taking calcium out of arteries, I think it's always prudent, and I've said this many times, that if you're going to take calcium supplements or drink or eat lots of dairy, take some vitamin K2, because vitamin K2 is made in a healthy microbiome, which many of us don't have, and it helps direct calcium away from the arteries and into the bones. So that is evidence-based, and I probably could cite Dr. Greger some deeper kind of systems biology to help him understand that maybe these epidemiologic studies aren't enough to draw a conclusion that calcium causes heart disease or cancer or, in fact, bone fractures, all of which he sort of hints at in this blog post. And I want to jump to a second vitamin D story, and this one about vitamin D supplementation in ulcerative colitis. Now, remember what I said about high-dose vitamin D having very likely an adverse effect on bones because it's a hormone. And back in the day, before we had some of our current drugs, if a woman was suffering from a uterine hemorrhage and you thought it was because she had too much estrogen, what you did was give her a ginormous dose of estrogen, which seems very paradoxical, but it stopped the hemorrhage. And then you went and did a D&C and got rid of the accumulated tissue that the estrogen had been driving that had finally started to hemorrhage. But the point is, you can't really even do the surgery until you've stabilized the patient, and we would use massive doses of estrogens. And that's where I first got acquainted with this concept of hormesis. Sounds like hormone, hormesis. And hormesis means that hormones are biphasic. Too much of the hormone will behave like not enough of the hormone. And that has to do with the fact that hormones have receptors, that there is a dynamic system here, and that the dynamic system, if you're yelling at it too loud, simply turns off its ears. And you can exploit that, as we did in the case of the uterine hemorrhages. How this is working in the case of ulcerative colitis, I can't say, but I do think that's what's going on with these bone density studies. So this was a study done in India at Chandigarh's Postgraduate Institute of Medical Education. The lead researcher was Rizwan Ahmed Z. And he recruited 110 patients with active ulcerative colitis, and they took only people who were not taking vitamin D supplements and had severe disease, and they randomized them to either 60,000 units of vitamin D3 once a day for 8 days or placebo. And then they measured them at baseline and again at 4 weeks, all kinds of things, sed rate, C-reactive protein, fecal calprotectin, which is a compound that is produced by white blood cells. And if you've got a lot of white blood cells running around your colon, it will go up. They also looked at things like how often were they pooping? Were they in remission? How symptomatic were they? What they saw was a substantial decrease in symptoms, a 3-point reduction on a 10-point scale. So in the vitamin D group, 53% got better in the month. In the placebo group, 13% got better. So that's about 400% better. If I were a drug company, that's how I'd say it. Vitamin D is 400% better than nothing. They saw statistically significant inverse relationships as well with CRP and calprotectin. In terms of blood levels, the high dose, 60,000 units once a day, and this is a lot. Okay, they did that for 8 days. Their level went from 15 to 40, which is not considered to be a toxic level, but because it went up so fast, the vitamin D levels were so high that they had a serious anti-inflammatory effect. We're not sure how that works. It may have worked through changing the microbiome, for all I know. We don't know, but we do know that this is pretty good evidence that vitamin D can be beneficial in a lot of circumstances where we haven't thought about it having anything to do with bones. And so I thought that you would enjoy hearing about that study. I'm going to talk about ambulatory blood pressure monitoring. This is something that most people have heard about in the context of white coat hypertension, where people come in and they say, you know, my blood pressure is going to be high, doc. It's always high in the doctor's office. It's never high when I take it at home. And I'm like, okay, well, that's interesting. Next time you come in, bring your blood pressure cuff and you show me. Show me it's high here on your cuff, and then I'll believe that, and I won't press you to start on a program of all of the DASH diet things and exercise and L-arginine and or antihypertensives, if that's what you tell me that you want because you need it easy because you're so busy. This is a much better way to figure that out, and that's ambulatory blood pressure medicine, where you wear something that just inflates every 24 hours, and it measures your blood pressure every 15 minutes, records it, and we can see not just what the fluctuation is, which can give you a lot of useful information about vascular health, because if it goes up and stays up from a short-term stressor, like you got startled by somebody jumping in front of you on the freeway, it should go up for, you know, 5 minutes and then come back down again. It'll go up with exercise, and then it should come down and stay down. And if it doesn't do that, you'll remember the tooth microbiome study from a few weeks ago. That means that you aren't making that nitric oxide, and that's important to understand. So with respect to ambulatory blood pressure, there's a phenomenon called dipping. And the dipping means that in the evening, your blood pressure, your systolic blood pressure, the upper number, I think superior for systolic and down for diastolic. Anyway, the systolic blood pressure should drop 10 to 15% if you've got a healthy vasculature system. And if it doesn't do that, you don't see the dipping, there's an increased risk of death and heart disease and mortality and morbidity. And the absence of dipping or reverse dipping, where it goes up at night, assuming that you're on a daytime work, nighttime sleep schedule, those are signs that the system is destabilizing and one needs to take urgent intervention. But if you try to get ambulatory blood pressure, you won't find it easily because doctor's offices mostly don't bother with it. I'm proud to announce that very shortly we will have ambulatory blood pressure for my patients in my office because I think that I'd like to get ahead of the curve on predicting what might happen to my folks and deciding how aggressive do I have to be and do they really have white coat hypertension or do they just not want to take drugs and not want to do the hard work of diet and exercise. And if that's the case, we need to continue the conversation. Let's go to our first call, and that is Bill in Santa Cruz. Hello, Bill. You're on the air.
Hi.
Hi. How are you doing?
Very good. So my brother has been diagnosed with diverticulitis, and he's stable now. Initially, they were recommending surgery. At this point, they shifted now they call it diverticulosis. So he's I guess that's an ongoing chronic disease that he has now that's managed.
Yeah, osis is structural, and itis is when the structure becomes inflamed.
I see. So my question is the role of the microbiome, of course, and what role that might have to play in helping improve his health.
It's a very good question. Yes.
Yeah.
Well, start with the fact that the treatment for diverticulitis is massive doses of antibacterials. And so to get someone from itis to osis, and you definitely want to do that because you don't want them having a ruptured diverticula and dumping bacteria all over the inside of their bowel, outside of the colon, inside of their abdomen, I should say. That leads to massive infection, possible sepsis, and death. So there are moments when antibiotics are a good thing, and diverticulitis is one such moment. I don't recommend sitting this one out. It's like trying to sit out a case of appendicitis. It does respond well to the antibiotics, and they are life-saving. But once you've got back to the osis, you've also trashed your bowel. at least temporarily, and you need to do everything you can to support his microbiome. And in the short term, I give extra probiotics. I take a little history, you know. So were you a C-section? Did you have a lot of antibiotics in childhood? Do you have a lot of GI problems? If I get somebody who was vaginal delivery, breastfed, didn't have a lot of antibiotics in childhood, I love the Christian Scientist babies. They're probably the only people with good, with decent bowels in around. But anyway, the microbiome in someone who's never had antibiotics is way better. But even there, they're getting every time they eat a hamburger, they're getting antibiotics. So there's still quite a lot of reduced diversity in people eating the standard American diet. But you want to really feed those bugs. So you take bugs, you feed prebiotics, which are things like root vegetables, apples is another great source, artichokes, Jerusalem artichokes, celeriac. These all have a great range of healthy probiotics and prebiotics. And then you get the fermented foods, sauerkraut, kimchi, kefir, yogurt. And you try to create a sort of fake healthy ecosystem. And the spores and the residual potential seeds, if you will, of the old microbiome come back. And then the question is, can you get the old microbiome back well enough? And it depends on how good it was in the first place. If it was good enough over, you know, a few years, you can get it back. One way to decide, you know, what, if you have a bad microbiome to start with, you're more likely to have constipation, and or diarrhea, but you don't have normal stools. And therefore you have, in the case of constipation, a much higher risk over your lifetime of developing diverticulosis, which is a disease, is a low fiber disease. You either have a genetic malformation or you have a low fiber diet. And so lifelong high fiber diet for the rest of your life, once you're diagnosed with diverticulosis, will, and there is a study years old that showed that the structural changes actually reverse. Because, you know, you rebuild your body every 7 years. And as you rebuild your gut, you rebuild it according to the circumstances of its current situation, not its previous situation. And so as long as there's good bones, good microbiome seeds, he can get back to good. And I don't know where he's starting out. People who start out poorly, the C-section baby who had a lot of ear infections, I'm going to leave that person on probiotics. I'm going to ask them to continue with the fermented food and view this as just a long-term behavioral change. I may or may not give them supplemental probiotics. And I certainly will encourage them to eat a high-fiber diet, because that's even standard medical advice. That's sort of the quick and dirty download. Follow-up questions, please.
Oh, sure. Relative importance of improving the meat portion of the diet, avoiding meat products that have been treated with antibiotics.
Definitely that. Meat tends to be constipating. So you're taking enough fiber when you poop twice a day and you don't have to push. So I call that the horse poop. You know, you watch the horse on the trail. It's just, they're walking along. They don't even bat an eye. It's just out, splat. And so you want that kind of a situation. If you're blocking the toilet, good. That means that you're getting enough fiber. And you can't just eat the fiber. You got to eat the fluid or drink the fluid, because otherwise you end up with a sort of cement situation that has to be dealt with medically in ways that we do not need to describe on the radio, but which I'm sure you can imagine.
Sure. Yeah. No, I have other sources for cement.
Indeed. Good. Any other questions for your brother?
No.
All right.
That's about it.
And so because you share a certain percentage of his DNA, you would be well advised to also engage in fiber and fermented foods.
Yeah. I'm the one with the good diet.
Excellent. Well, you know, I see a lot of that around this place.
Yeah. Okay, thanks so much.
Thanks for your call. I'm sure you've helped other people. Bye-bye. We just got an email through the on-air at KSQD. So Great. This comes from Troy. My aching back from Pacific Grove. There's a lot of hype about CBD oil. Can you tell us what is known about it, what it is good for, and possible dangers or other drug interactions? For example, 74-year-old woman suffering from sciatica. MRI and physical exam indicates spondylolisthesis rather than piriformis syndrome, but trying to avoid surgery by doing PT, but the pain is considerable. Would CBD oil help with the pain? Many local distributors now sell topical creams that are CBD only and ones that are 50% CBD and 50% THC. Which would be best? And what should one look for on labels of active ingredients? And does one just rub it on, and where and how often? Okay, so there's a lot to unpack here, Troy. Let's start with mechanism. I think that's a good place to start, always a good place to start. And CBD has two different actions. It has an action in the nervous system, and it has an action in the in the immune system. So the action on the immune system is that it is an anti-inflammatory. And actually, there is a form of THC that's an anti-inflammatory. And that's where I would start with this 74-year-old woman, is I'd actually have her make marijuana flower tea and start drinking about a pea-size amount of marijuana flower, that's sometimes called flower bud, and that should have THC in it. Because it's the THC is not active in the brain. It doesn't get you stoned until it gets burnt. So it's the burning or the heating it up to a high temperature that causes changes in the parent compound. The parent compound itself is the carboxylic acid THC, and that's tetrahydrocannabinoid carboxylate. That stuff is not bioactive. It's water soluble, so you can pull that out with just hot water like you were making a cup of tea. And it's anti-inflammatory through a mechanism I have yet to hear elucidated. It is, however, you can measure the effects on the system, and there's an overall reduction of all of the stuff that Motrin and ibuprofen and Advil and Aleve and all of the Arutis, all of them, they go after the COX, the cyclooxygenase and the lipooxygenase pathways, but particularly cyclooxygenase. They do it very well. There's some problems with that, which we're all familiar with. But this THC carboxylate does the same thing. So you can use that. It takes a little bit longer to kick in, maybe 7 to 10 days, but a couple of cups of tea, one in the morning and one at night, totally benign. Now, what about CBD as a topical? I use it with great success in neuropathic pain. That is to say, people who have a strong, who have damaged nerves. And it works great in the feet. But the problem is we're treating the small fibers. They're not myelinated fibers, so they don't have insulation on them, and they're right under the skin. And there's not a lot of fat on the skin, so of the feet. So you can actually get reasonable penetration to the area where you need to get penetration with a CBD salve or ointment or oil rubbed into the feet. And I would rub in for a minute or two to try to improve the penetration. If you've got a little ultrasound device or a little vibrating device, even just a vibrating massager would probably help increase the penetration. If the person's a very skinny 74-year-old woman, it might work. It might work well. If they've got a reasonable amount of back fat, I don't know if you're going to get down using a topical. You may have to go to oral. And if you're going to use an oral compound, then you run into the problem of, well, if I don't want to get high, I just have to use CBD. And there, while you'll get good absorption in the stomach, the amount that you'll get into the brain is debatable. Some maybe, People certainly do report that if they take oral CBD, they sleep better. You might be better trying to put it under the tongue and get it, go after good sleep as a strategy. Many people use smoking or vaping. You can still vape if you use a volcano or some other device that just heats the marijuana plant. That isn't going to introduce any of these additional compounds into the airstream. And I'm convinced that that's pretty safe because that technology has been around for, I think, close on 15 years that I'm aware of. And I haven't seen any reports of problems from it. Although, you know, absence of evidence is not the same thing as evidence of absence. But that being said, let's leave it at that. What do you look for on the labels? The strongest you can find. In a small little jar of CBD salve, you're looking for maybe 50 milligrams. Nobody seems to be putting percentages out there, which is what they should be doing. And that wasn't written into the legislations or the licensing. So we're going to need to fix that so that you can compare apples to oranges. Because right now, go in there with a calculator, see how many grams is in the jar. You're trying for the highest concentration. So divide the milligrams by the grams in the jar, and that's going to give you a percentage. Get the one with the highest percent that you can find. I would like to just follow up on that email. No real side effects except drowsiness. Not worried about it having any effect on eye pressure. If anything, it'll have a beneficial effect. And you don't get a low eye pressure crisis if you do take too many glaucoma drugs. That's or get an additional lowering of the pressure. That's not dangerous for the vision. So this from Mardine and Ben Lomond. Hi, Dr. Don. I hear advice from medically based sources, including you and Dr. Hyman, that a variety of tests could be very helpful in determining lifestyle changes, supplements, drugs, and treatments that would improve my health. I know that such testing would be undertaken with guidance, should be undertaken with guidance from a doctor, but I assume that the cost would be prohibitive, and I just don't feel the urgency to dive down that rabbit hole. Now there are many online companies offering at-home testing that promise to give you lab results interpreted by, quote, board-certified doctors at affordable prices. Examples include Everlywell, MyLabBox, Let's Get Checked, and Ulta Lab Tests. Are any of these legitimate? Can you recommend a particular test as a good overview of health status to use as a baseline? Please address this on your podcast. I think a lot of health-conscious people are wondering the same thing, and some could easily be duped into spending hundreds of dollars for unnecessary or inaccurate testing. Well, Mardine, I can't really speak to the accuracy issue that easily here because a lot of these are blood spot tests, and the standards for that have a little bit more wiggle room than the standards for blood tests, like when you take a tube of blood, because obviously only one of these two of the ones you mentioned do blood tests. So let's start with in order. MyLabBox. These are definitely marketing to sexually active young people. Their primary focus is fertility and STD. They do have a celiac test and a diabetes screen. I don't think their heavy metal test makes any sense, and I'll explain why later. Celiac, I can't judge because I don't know what tests they're doing. I will say that celiac testing is only about, at best, 80% accurate, and that is only accurate if you've been eating bread and gluten. If you haven't been, then there's no way that you can really be accurately ruled out for celiac, except a DNA test, which is not what they're offering. A1C to screen for diabetes is not going to pick up really early insulin resistance, but it will pick up diabetes before or pre-diabetes before you start damaging your kidney. So that might be a good thing for somebody to check on themselves if they eat a standard American diet. Heavy metals is based on you're having a constant exposure to the metals. This is a finger stick blood test. They're dropping blood onto a blotter paper. That's not going to be accurate if you have accumulated body burden, like, say, from mercury in your fillings that you've had removed over the years, or lead in your bones from exposure to lead acid batteries or just lead in the gasoline while you were growing up. blood spot testing, you'll remember Theranos, that fiasco, that very charismatic woman who managed to put one over on Walgreens and a whole bunch of other people, former Secretary of State, I think. Her. Ulta lab tests is probably the most ethical and standard of them. This is a leveraged discount. They don't offer any MD services. The idea is that you will order a panel like Standard Labs. They have cholesterol, vitamin D, things like that. This one seems pretty legit. And again, they're just a leveraged discount service. They're probably based in Florida. There are a few states that let that patients order their own blood tests. Florida is one. Walk-in Labs, Life Extension, number of other places you may have heard of, use this. Who am I to call it a loophole? It's freedom. And they can have a contract with a lab in California to draw the blood and test it, but officially they're the ones who are licensed, and you're buying it in Florida or whatever, Wisconsin, Nebraska. Let's Get Checked.com. They do have some panels. Their wellness panel looked like a really superficial kind of screening test, but it would find the big things. It would just check cholesterol. Of course, it does check hsCRP. If there's one test, if I had to pick like one test to monitor, it would be hsCRP, because if you're inflamed, you're going to die of something earlier than you otherwise would. So walking around with a high hsCRP, and it's usually lowercase hs, uppercase CRP, having a normal below one level, not below three, which is what PAMF uses and is not normal, then you are in good shape. And if there's only one test to do annually because you think you're doing great, that would be that and an A1C, because a lot of, I see a lot of skinny people who are pre-diabetic. Those would be the big two. Cholesterol, I'm kind of an agnostic on. If you've got a really seriously high cholesterol, then maybe it makes sense to, check it once. See if it's over 300. If it is, you definitely should go see a doctor. If it's over 250, then you need to get a second test and see whether those are large particles, HDL, in which case you don't worry, or small particles, in which case you should worry. I don't recommend screening for a CBC, which is the complete blood count, unless you feel sick. If you have a fever, yeah, get one. If you feel tired all the time and you're running out of breath going upstairs, yeah, that'd be a top spot, because anemia and internal bleeding happen. Let's see. Everly was another one you mentioned. They do a finger stick food IgG. This was the only functional medicine test I saw. And I think I'll probably look into that. Their price wasn't much better than the lab I use. But then again, it wasn't all that bad. Well, that's about all for this week's podcast. Please go to AskDrDawn.com for news about our future plans, or follow my tweets at AskDrDawn. For now, this is Dr. Dawn saying so long and stay healthy.
Ask Dr. Dawn is brought to you by Jiva Media. Production and editing by Charles Mansky. Music by John Scoville.